Hello, classical classmates. It's your host, Daisha. I am super excited for you to hear the episode you're about to hear because this is something that's never been done before in the history of classical music. Or at least on our show. So typically, in the classical music world, knowing the story of a piece of music is a little bit of a guessing game. Like, it's hard to know what Bach was thinking when he wrote the Goldberg Variations, or to know what really inspired Beethoven to write his Ninth Symphony. And, you know, we actually spend a lot of time on this show trying to piece such stories together from context clues and from letters that these people left behind and from notes that composers left in the margins of sheet music. But in today's episode, you'll hear the entire story of a piece of modern classical music from commission to performance. And as it turns out, it's a very American story in a lot of ways, actually, but particularly in that together, these people made something out of just an idea. Even the instrument that this piece, Music for Wood and Strings, is played on, it didn't exist before this story began. So you'll meet the composer, Bryce Dessner, the instrument maker, Aaron Sanchez, and the quartet who commissioned and plays the piece, So Percussion. And there is so much kick-ass music in this episode that I am going to stop talking so that I can actually go and listen to this again. By the way, don't forget to subscribe to us and to rate us and review us on iTunes if you want to hear more amazing stories of classical music. All right, Clay out. My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark
secret.
I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock, and I know something about jazz. But when it comes to classical, but I really want to learn. So, every week on this show, a classical music expert will give me a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the classical classroom. Hello, and welcome to Classical Classroom. I am Daisha Clay, and here with me in the studio is So Percussion. The members are Eric Chaw Beach, Josh Quillen, Adam Slewinski, and Jason Troiding. They met at Yale and have now put out 18 albums together. And from respective places outside the studio, in case you wonder why they sound a little different, are Aaron Sanchez and Bryce Dessner. Aaron is a musician, and he plays in the band Buke and Gace, who've been featured on one of my favorite shows, Radiolab. He's an instrument designer and maker and a sound engineer. And many of you may know Bryce Dessner as the guitarist of the band The National. He's also a classical music composer, and he's worked with everyone from the Los Angeles Philharmonic to Nico Muhly. Guys, welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm just going to get right to it. So, Adam Slewinski, let's start with you. How did this whole thing get started?
So the piece is called Music for Wood and Strings, and we always pronounce it very carefully like that because otherwise it sounds like music for wooden strings. We don't have wooden strings, they're normal strings. Bryce is somebody that we've known for a long time. He was actually a grad student at Yale at the same time that some of us were in classical guitar. But he's best known these days as being a songwriter and guitarist in the band The National, which he formed with his twin brother, Aaron, and some friends of his from high school. And they're a very big band and a very wonderful band.
All that breaks behind the houses, I don't see what's strange about this. Tiny bubbles hang above me, it's a sign of someone.
And it's neat because we've known Bryce for a long time. He also has this career as being a big rock star and whatever. He's a really interesting composer. I guess we would call, say, classical composer.
People ask me a lot about my background.
This is the composer, Bryce Dessner.
You know, the truth of the matter is that all the classical music came first. So I grew up playing flute and then switched to classical guitar and started composing. And I did very formal training at the Conservatory of Music in Cincinnati, and then my undergrad and graduate studies at Yale in music. And in my early 20s, you know, as the band was getting going, my primary, you know, job was really playing contemporary music and playing chamber music in New York City. And that's during the period where I've been really lucky to kind of sort of in the generation that I sit in, I was able to tour with people like Philip Glass and Steve Reich and perform with Terry Riley and mm-hmm. premiere pieces by lots of different composers. And so I have an education, I guess, in contemporary music, and it's, you know, as much my first love as playing in bands.
So you've known these guys in So Percussion for a long time.
I actually went to school with So. So we met in the late 90s at Yale School of Music back then in our early 20s. And then, you know, we've always been friends and kind of come up in the same musical environment in New York. Mm-hmm. So it was sort of a natural evolution of that friendship that they eventually asked me to write a piece for them.
So, Adam, you guys wanted Bryce to write a piece for you. How does it get started? Where does the process begin?
He had an idea to invent this new instrument, which we call a cord stick, which is a kind of string instrument. So in some ways, it stays a little closer to what Bryce does and knows every day, being such an excellent guitarist. But he put a spin on it. He put a twist on it. And when he invented this instrument, he had the idea that they'd be strings, it'd be plugged in, it would sound like an electric guitar, but you would play it like a percussionist would play anything mm-hmm. or most things, which is to mm-hmm. take something and hit it. So that makes it more similar to something like a hammered dulcimer or a cimbalum or something like that.
Yeah.
So he built this whole piece of music collaborating with us, Music for Wood and Strings, and it ends up being kind of a really interesting amalgamation of ideas and styles. You can really hear folk music, folk influence when you think of like Appalachia with hammered dulcimer. Mm-hmm. But it is a very composed, structured piece, very much coming out of the tradition of a composer like Steve Reich mm-hmm. and the minimalism movement. So those are kind of some of the things that are thrown into the pot all together to make this piece of music.
So Bryce, what were you thinking about in the beginning? What was rumbling around in your head when you first started thinking about this piece?
Yeah, I had an idea of a sound, and I knew I wanted to work with really simple instruments, almost primitive in terms of their, you know, how, you know, the materials anyone could buy. It's just, you know, 2x4s with strings on them, essentially, with simple contact microphones. Mm-hmm. But it was a sound that I had dreamt about, and sort of, you know, in my own work, something I was building towards creating. It's almost a little bit like electronic music in the way it's sort of these repetitive, very quick patterns that are quite difficult to play. But, you know, so percussion are so good at that specific thing, but they really needed an instrument to do it on.
He'd been writing in this way where he had thought of music in terms of a chord hocket.
By the way, this is Jason Troiding.
He'd been writing music for guitars. He'd been writing for strings, music called chord hocket. So where you'd have, if you had two guitarists, maybe one guitarist would have one chord, the other guitarist would have another chord, and you'd go quickly back and forth and hear these two chords going back and forth pretty quickly. And he thought, oh, that kind of music would be great to write for percussionists, but what could they play it on? Oh, maybe if I invent this instrument that kind of sounds like an electric guitar, comes from that thing, but you know, the rhythms that happen on it could happen in a way that only percussionists could play. That was kind of the first seed.
I kind of dreamt of it, but I didn't have an instrument. It was a percussive string music inspired by American string band music or bluegrass, were sort of the rhythms that you might hear and played on a clawhammer banjo. But I was imagining it played by percussionists with really precise, really fast interlocking rhythms, kind of guitar music in a way that guitarists could never play. And so that I was sort of, you know, eventually stumbled on the idea of sort of a dulcimer-like instrument, but I needed someone to build it specifically for percussionists to play. And so that's how I asked Aaron to do it.
Aaron Sanchez, this really awesome instrument builder. Another great band called Buick and Gase. He plays in that band and builds all their instruments and is good friends with Bryce. And so Bryce said, oh, Aaron, I have this idea. Can you kind of build it for us?
So, Aaron, thanks for being here. So you augment instruments that already exist, and you invent brand new instruments from the ground up. Your instruments have been used with projects like the Blue Man Group and in your own band, Buick and Gase. So my first question to you is, what do you have against instruments that already exist?
Nothing at all. Yeah, it's tricky because a lot of the things that you can do with, you know, physics and sound have been done already. But I guess I like reinventing the wheel and just seeing how far I can push the limits of, you know, what's possible. And there's also like there's always times when you think of something that hasn't been made.
Yeah.
And maybe it's slightly different than something that already exists, but you need it to do something a little bit different, so you make it. Like with my band Buke and Gace, like we are trying to produce more sound than you can do with a normal guitar.
So we had
to take guitar-like instruments and modify them so that they could do more things, like have a wider range, so mm-hmm. I can do like bass and guitar at the same time, mm-hmm. things like that. So that's where, you know, then I'm like, okay, let's figure out how to do that and I'll make it.
Yeah.
And then the other side is that I just love making things and working with my hands, and I always have. So that just plays into my musical world.
Yeah.
So it just becomes a part of it, and the two are enmeshed.
That long day of giving. So you built this whole new instrument for So Percussion. It's called a chord stick. Whose idea was it?
That was Bryce. We had been talking for a little while before that about collaborating on something having to do with, you know, me making some instruments for something that he would compose for.
Mm-hmm.
So we finally, you know, he approached me a couple of years ago, and he had this concept for this this chord stick instrument, basically a stringed instrument that could be played percussively with sticks or bows or whatever you wanted, but you know, specifically for So Percussion to perform on, and they're primarily percussionists. So he had a general concept of it, no music yet. He wanted to like have the instrument first and then write the music for the instrument. We kind of went back and forth about different ideas of how it could be, how many strings it would have, you know, how it would be played, how it would be amplified, and we developed it over a few months.
So Bryce had some idea of what he wanted.
He was like, it just needs to be a block of wood with strings on it. And then we kind of like developed it from there.
Oh, okay. I see.
He had a concept for the sound. He wanted it to sound very acoustic and very string-like, but also be able to be electric. And early on, he had the idea that it would go through different effects pedals and stuff. That didn't quite end up happening, but they are electrified. They're going through amplifiers, and they, you know, has this like kind of electric guitar sound, but also very acoustic sounding. You can hear all the little subtleties of the strings and stuff when the sticks are striking it. So it's very percussive, and they're very chord, like they're always playing more than one string at once. So it's like this very chordal thing, which is why they're called chord sticks, I guess.
So Bryce, how did you guys actually approach the process of making the instrument?
Yeah, Aaron built a prototype, and I started working with the prototype and playing around with it myself and improvising on it. And then we actually built a second one. So we kind of, you know, he gave it to me, and then I played it. And even there's actually a national song on the last national album, which is the first appearance of this instrument. Don't tell Carnegie Hall, but yeah. So the first time it was used was at the end of a song called Don't Swallow the Cap. I did kind of a short distorted version of like an improv essentially with it. You know, I was lucky that I chose Aaron actually to build this thing, because, you know, I had total confidence in him. But what he built is really a beautiful instrument, and it just works incredibly well. It's very stable and it's very fun to play. And so it wasn't hard. You know, I would say that luck went into it a little bit, but more than that, I think his skill as an instrument builder just made this very solid design.
It's kind of interesting because the chord sticks, being brand new instruments, kind of were limitless when they were still in the process of being developed and built.
This is Eric Chabich, a percussionist with So Percussion.
But it feels like he really focused in on the sound of the strings. And in fact, we even talked at the beginning, oh yeah, we could plug this into reverb pedals and delay pedals like an electric guitar player would do in a band. But the sound of the strings was just so sort of rich and complex that he ended up just becoming obsessed with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, you know, you think about there's like 30-something strings between all four instruments. And that richness of sound in and of itself just becomes this kind of whole new world. It's sort of like if 8 guitar players were all playing together at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And when all of that resonance is happening, you kind of end up, it sounds to me like there are effects on it, or you start to hear crazy things in the overtones. The thing I think that's great about it is that because you can't quite imagine what these instruments are going to sound like until mm-hmm. they exist, you can't like compose music for them in your head. You have that image of like the classical composer as like Mozart wandering around and like coming up with ideas in his head, and all he has to do is put them down on the paper, but the idea is there already.
Yeah.
And it's like this kind of music doesn't exist until you play the instrument and realize what it sounds like and what it does.
So you have to experiment.
Yeah, so it flips it on its head.
So Aaron, as the instrument maker, once you've handed over the chord stick, like, do you stay involved in the process with the musicians learning the noises that the instrument can make and all that kind of stuff?
Well, after I built them and we decided they were done, then I think So Percussion and Bryce like spent a bunch of time with them mm-hmm. and they kind of figured out, you know, what was the best thing to play them with.
Okay. And so when did the pencils get involved in this equation?
You know, they probably needed something like a stick the diameter of a pencil, and pencil was probably the best thing because they probably had them around.
Right.
And maybe that's how it ended up being pencils. I'm mm-hmm. not sure.
You have these instruments and you're like, wow, what can be done on these instruments? What happens if you ...
This is Jason again.
You know, and that I think was just like, you know, days of us all in a room messing around. And what happens if you put a bow to the instrument? What happens if you pluck it? What happens if you put your fingers here to get a harmonic? What happens with pencils? Ah, pencils actually sound pretty cool. Like, we thought maybe pencils would just be the kind of substitute. But whoa, the metal sounds a little different than the wood. And, you know, then it was just this like kind of long stream of what sounds can we get out of this instrument?
We've talked a lot about the instruments and how they're made and built.
This is Josh Quillen from So Percussion.
What you're hearing are four different instruments that are sort of set up like soprano, alto, tenor, bass. Three of the instruments have two chords tuned on them, and they're two different chords. Jason, I believe, has the highest one, is that right?
Yeah.
And then Eric has the second highest set of chords. Adam has the sort of tenor set of chords. And then I've got one chord. I don't have a second chord, but I have kind of a mono chord or a bass string that is fretted. And throughout the piece, that's the only real melodic content that happens. Everything else is based on either like plucking a single string, which happens occasionally, or hitting a chord with a pencil like this.
Pencils.
Yeah, pencil. This is a Sharpie, but yeah. And so there's a lot of just like drumming with the pencils. And Jason mentioned the metal thing at the end of like a typical number two pencil. There's mm-hmm. that little metal sleeve that holds the eraser. Oddly, it helps create a nice little metallic tone on the string itself. You can also take things up. There's a nice, cool section that kind of reminds us a little bit of Electric Counterpoint a little bit, this right, beautiful Reich piece where there's this awesome strumming, which actually probably was the hardest part of the piece for us to learn because we're not guitarists. And we were just sitting there, like, fumbling all over it. And Bryce would come over. He's like, oh, you just do this. And he
just like that.
Is a beautiful guitarist and is able to do that really well. So,
which was very sneaky of him as a composer, by the way.
Oh, and this is Adam.
To come in the room and instead of writing for stuff that we're the experts on, uh-huh. and he's just the composer, would be like, Bryce, let me show you how this is done. Instead, it was like, actually, guys, let me show you how this is done. Here's how you hold a harmonic. Here's how you strum it. And we're like,
that's kind of interesting.
Okay, thanks.
Like yeah. He was, as a composer, getting in there with the people who are going to
totally
be performing
in
it.
His own comfort zone in a really cool
well,
way.
It's wow. a nice mix of like, I mean, percussionists, I feel like have a rich history of being asked to do the thing that nobody else in the orchestra will do. Like we mm-hmm. talk often of an American in Paris, there are these car horns that
yeah.
are played.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's not hard to play the car horn. Anybody in the orchestra could have played the car horn. They didn't give it to the French horn players to play the car horn. They gave it to the drummer to go. And strumming itself is not like playing the guitar. The strumming is not the hard part of playing guitar. It's the like all the crazy like
yeah.
fretting and picking. So Bryce was like, I think you guys can do this. This is not a problem. So I'm 36 years old and never been asked to do that before on a piece and had to figure out how to do it.
So was it intimidating or exciting to be confronted with this whole new instrument and to be the first ones to use it?
When I think that for us, like when we talk about our lineage, we talk a lot about minimalism and Steve Reich kind of in the mid, late 60s. Uh-huh. We kind of go farther back than that and talk about this really rich American experimental tradition, going back to folks like John Cage and Lou Harrison and Harry Partch and folks that really like, you know, we're studying music in a classical sense, but kind of like, you know, we're wanting to write this music that didn't exist and couldn't, the classical percussionists at that time didn't really want to be playing that music. They were like, wait a minute, no, we're playing car horns in Gershwin, you know, like, I don't want to be playing your thing. And so that, I think it was kind of this really this practical thing of like, well, I can't get the snare drums and the timpani in the orchestra because those guys won't play with me, but I can find a tin can and a weird drum in the shop on the corner and, you know, make a buzzer that I can play rhythmically and tune a pipe. And so let me put together this really kind of like ragtag ensemble almost, you know, it's just this real like kind of, I don't know, you know, just this kind of like funky mishmash, make my own thing happen. And I think we come a lot out of that tradition too. And where a lot of kind of American experimentalism is coming from, this kind of practical DIY.
Our friend and colleague, Steve Mackey, we all teach at Princeton. We're the ensemble in residence at Princeton. And Steve is one of the composers there. He calls it the American crackpot tradition. And we love that. We think it sums up the sense of invention. Sometimes it's the sense of going off the beaten path and sort of setting tradition aside and saying, what's in front of me? So when John Cage invented the prepared piano, he had a very small amount of space and a piano, and he wanted to do a percussion orchestra, but he just didn't have the resources. So he's like, well, what if I just start messing with this piano, putting screws inside the instrument and all this kind of stuff? And he invented it through this kind of happenstance DIY kind of thing. And there's so much of that. It's really rich in certainly many different traditions, but for us, the American tradition is really interesting. It's something we come out of. Percussion was the vehicle. Percussionists were the vehicle for so much of that, for so many composers. Mm-hmm. So many, in many respects, we don't tend to specialize in, I'm a guy who plays this instrument, although each of us do have our own interests. We're more a group that is just kind of up for anything. We're open to the possibility of, you could just throw something new at us and we'll try it out. That's kind of what we specialize in, actually.
We keep saying DIY, and like, I feel like...
This is Josh.
So, hi. I feel like so percussion, like if we were to build this instrument, it would actually be DIY.
It would be terrible.
Like, there'd be like, somehow there'd be a t-shirt tied to it, holding it together, and it'd be like super...
It'd be a lot of gaff tape.
Be a lot of gaff tape, and there, yeah. Aaron is like, it's like, here, I made this thing for you. It's a Porsche.
It's, you know, it's, and he's beautiful. Like,
it's beautiful. And it's pretty much indestructible. And if you need me to change anything on it, just let me know.
Wow.
Like, he made Eric this instrument called a Bobo Tarong, just kind of on a whim based on something Eric was playing. And he made these cool modifications to it. He built me a lap steel with a modified lap steel with a bass string on it. And it was just like, you know, Aaron, I like this. And he's like, okay, cool. And then he sent me this thing, and it's like absolutely gorgeous and sounds amazing. So I want to come up with a new category for Aaron other than DIY. I don't know what that is, but he's a step above what.
He's deluxe.
He has
DIY.
It's a new category.
Yeah. His company is called Polyphonic Workshop. Like, it's a thing that he runs and owns. Like, his own little building. He makes these amazing amplifiers and all these like custom instruments. So like, if you're in need of something that you can't find in a store, you should email Aaron and he could probably build it for you, and it'd be amazing.
That spot we went to last night, what was it called? Hey Merchant.
Hey Merchant.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Aaron sells his beers at Hey Merchant. We're more of like a moonshine kind of like making beer in our basement kind of like. Please don't come to us for that. He's like, he's at the highest level.
How did Bryce go about composing a piece for a whole new instrument?
When we were in school together, he heard kind of the first big piece of music that we commissioned. And I think it was a piece by David Lang called The So-Called Laws of Nature. And it was a big influence on us, but it's awesome to realize that it was a huge influence on him too. And this piece of music really creates this whole new world for what a percussion piece could sound like, really. Uh-huh. What, you know, it's a 35-minute piece. And so when he wrote this piece, he thought, okay, they're going to be playing this on the same concert as this David Lang piece. What can I create to be a totally new world to live in for 35 minutes. You know, so I think he was really kind of addressing the collaboration in terms of, man, I really want to step up and create something totally new. Because, you know, what I know about them is they, with David, created this totally new sound world also. And, you know, I think he saw it as this awesome challenge of like, how can I make a whole new place for the audience to live in, you know?
So Bryce, you're working from a place of being confronted with this sort of musical challenge. But what actually inspired you? Like, where did you find inspiration to write this piece?
You know, I love process music, music that kind of tells you what it's doing as it's doing it, but then it has a certain mystery to it. And so, you know, I think probably the Goldberg Variations by Bach is the most, you know, the earliest and most famous example of that, where it has a kind of formula it's playing through. So, you know, I started with something like that in mind, and then my instrumental music has tended to be very based on European forms. You know, there's a string quartet I wrote for Kronos Quartet called Tenebrae that's inspired by the Holy Week Mass, and there's a piece called Lacrimae, which is inspired by a famous piece of Renaissance music by John Dowland. And so there's, you know, been a lot of, I've done a lot of work inspired by Renaissance music and even by literature and painting. And for this piece, I wanted to veer more American. And so I was, you know, specifically my background, you know, I started playing music because I fell in love with guitarists like John Fahey and Dwayne Allman of the Allman Brothers. And, you know, sort of back to my roots in a way of growing up in Ohio and playing steel string guitar and these things. And so in a way, the piece, while being ambitious and sort of, you know, pretty far afield and writing for a brand new instrument, is actually very closely related to my identity as a guitarist and sort of even, I would say, my background playing in the National and whatnot. So there was, you know, I guess a simultaneously, you know, a thinking that I wanted to make an ambitious, you know, large scale formal work for so percussion that would, you know, could occupy one half of a concert, but also a work that somehow reflects my background pretty closely, you know, as opposed to, say, when I'm writing like a large orchestra piece where, you know, is a kind of a distant relative to what I might do otherwise in other parts of my musical life.
So this was a little more personal than some other pieces that you've been commissioned to work on.
Yeah, it's very personal, I would say, a very personal piece. I mentioned electronic music, you know, there's some really brilliant, there's a sort of mid-70s album by a woman named Lori Spiegel, who's kind of overlooked American composer, really amazing, you know, experimenting with early synthesizers and whatnot. And her music inspired me actually a little bit with this piece that I was listening over and over again to a piece of hers. And I thought, oh, wouldn't it be cool if I could create an acoustic piece kind of in the same feeling.
So you're working with a whole new instrument, and you're talking about creating a new sound environment, a new soundscape. Like, is there a new style of writing down the composition? How did you actually present the piece of music to So Percussion?
The entire piece is written, so there's a score. I really delivered them the finished piece, but they were very involved in figuring out how to play it. Especially, you know, I had suggestions about how things should sound and, you know, what types of attack and what types of, you know, which mallets to use and shaping and color and stuff like that. But then they're so creative and so brilliant that really the end result, I would say, is very much a collaborative effort with them. But the notes were there. I think working with a new kind of bespoke instrument like that, it has its limitations, which really helps compositionally, actually, because so they're tuned to open chords. You know, each instrument has 8 strings. The bass instrument has a fretted string, so 1 fretted string. So the kind of melodies that you hear are actually played on the bass instrument. So I had a limited palette. The hard thing was choosing how to tune the instrument, so that took quite a long time. Yeah. I started with a more dissonant, sort of stacked dissonant tones. And the more I worked with it, you know, especially since it's a long piece, it's an ambitious, you know, almost 40-minute work, I felt that I wanted to stick closer to kind of the kinds of harmonies you might hear in a folk song. So they're actually tuned to kind of these open chords, beautiful resonant chords with some open intervals and things. And that was, you know, the main compositional tool was sort of picking out these open harmonies and then creating melodies that sort of happen between the chords and that type of thing.
So it's a really new piece of music, but it incorporates a lot of traditional elements as well.
There's also a few traditional percussion instruments. Everybody has a woodblock, also low to high. Jason has a snare drum that he plays with the back of a bow and some brushes from time to time. And then I have a kick drum that you'll hear in a second.
Interesting.
Yeah. So it's like this weird folky, or like a weird folk band.
Are you sitting when you're playing this stuff?
Yeah.
Okay.
Although, I strap mine around my. I was gonna say, kind of like a keytar.
I was going to say we should.
Don't actually. Yeah.
Final countdown.
Like, I don't know. Like this chord Hockett idea, or just a Hockett idea in general. Like, a lot of times when you hear these little wood blocks come in, I think it's me and Eric on different sides of the ensemble. And so a Hockett is when, well, a Hockett can be a lot of things, but in this case, it when me and him are playing the same type of rhythm and we're offsetting it a little bit. It's kind of like a canon, I guess. It's a canon kind of Hockett.
Yeah.
And that happens a lot in this music too, what you're hearing. So maybe one chord stick will be playing something pretty simple. And when you hear the next chord stick come in, it's that same music offset a little bit, which kind of ups its game.
Okay.
And he uses that a lot. And that, I think, is a technique he took from, you know, kind of this long lineage of music we play. Mm-hmm. I think Adam mentioned the minimalism that we kind of come out of the Steve Reich music. That's a technique that would be used a lot in that music that we gravitate towards pretty quickly.
The other sound that I hear, and you kind of mentioned this earlier, Jason, the Appalachia sound, I think that's such a curious mixture of sounds because, I mean, you know, they're basically opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, totally.
When you, like, you know, Appalachia is, you think of backwoods, far removed from civilization, and, you know, somebody like minimalism is attached to things that are very like ultra modern.
Yeah.
And to kind of like squish those together.
I think that's true, but I think that one of the things about minimalism that's really interesting is that it's people like Steve Reich, Philip Glass, they're people who were involved in and understood modernist movements in art and music. Mm-hmm. But there was an Americanness that they were plugging into, some of which has to do with things like jazz, you know, things that African diaspora music in general, rhythm and blues, jazz and things like that. With Appalachia, yes, to some extent removed from civilization, but to another extent, culturally, like a lot of our music is really plugged into the cultural stuff that comes from Appalachia and stuff like that. So actually minimalism really, it is a kind of modern movement, but that takes the American vernacular as a big, big influence and plugs it in. So I think that's where we feel like the way these things mix is really cool in this piece.
Yeah, and just instrumentally speaking, if you Google Appalachian dulcimer and you sort of squint at the images that come up, it kind of looks like this. It's a set of strings tuned over a long sort of body, kind of this weird looking guitar. The Appalachian dulcimer, I don't know all the history behind it, but is more similar to this, and I think was what Bryce was sort of imagining and looking at. So it's a nice mix between like a guitar. I mean, stretching a string over an instrument is a
pretty old idea.
Pretty old idea. Like the idea of a monochord of like just tuning one thing and then playing harmonics is a standard. I mean, that's happened for ages, and so it's a nice. He does a really good job of mixing these sort of like folky inspirations with this modern approach to playing the guitar.
And it does make like you were saying, Jason, like this interesting sound world.
Lot of the modernism we talked about earlier after World War II had a very heavy kind of negative energy to it. A lot of wonderful music made that way, but very intense kind of thing. Steve Reich, as a composer, was somebody who, to some extent, reintroduced the idea of ecstasy and joy into modern music. And it's actually something that matters to us. We like joy in modern music.
I'd say, too, the things that come to mind for me personally when I play this piece, but also any piece that we've commissioned or been in on the ground floor of, I tend to remember parts of the collaborative process as I'm even now, like when we've been playing these for what, like 2 years now or something like that. And it's like, I still remember there's certain bass lines or something that come up where I'm just like, oh man, I totally sucked at this when Bryce was in the room. And I have this very distinct image of trying to play this bass line. He's just like, it's cool, just play whatever you want. Yes. And it was like, that was his way of just like, I know you kind of stink at this. I, you know, you're missing a bunch of notes. And so it's like, there's one bass line, it's letter R. Every time it's the little, this one that I just, is still kind of a little tricky, but I always think of that moment in our old rehearsal studio when Bryce was just like, just play anything. Just play anything. there are these things that are, for me, when I play a piece that are very particular to my experience in the collaborative process that an audience is never going to know. But I have a hard time disassociating myself with, and just, it's hard to come to a piece for me and have a completely fresh experience because I have all these like cool war wounds with the piece from from day one.
So it's like more your personal story.
Yeah,
that's and part of the music.
We have to accept some responsibility with the piece in the way that its length and the way that it progresses, because Bryce just, everything you hear on the record is basically what Bryce brought in and gave to us on day one.
Yeah.
And we started learning it. And he's like, okay, I want to come in. I want to cut some stuff and make it flow a little better. And he's like, let's cut letter H. And we were like, no, letter H is cool. And so he's like, okay, well, what about letter J? No, you can't cut letter J. And so some people have been like, well, the piece is a little long and it's very sectional. It's like, yeah, that's not Bryce's fault. He wanted to make it a little smoother. We just became emotionally attached to like little specific things that happened in the
piece.
There's
one section we cut, and I think it's because I couldn't do that pick thing.
But anyway, it's those little things. Sometimes it's hard to convey to an audience that when a piece is performed for them and what they see and hear isn't always because the composer, that's what the composer initially intended. It's what oftentimes, at least with us, it's what the composer and the ensemble came to it together in discussions over a long period of time.
I kind of love that idea because I always think like these musicians that we hear in classical music are so fiercely, amazingly talented. And I know that they're bringing their own, you know, their own person to the music as well, but that's so rarely talked about, like what the...
And part of the reason for that is that who else they're bringing in is the previous 200 years of people who have also played that music.
Yeah.
My wife is a classical pianist, and the idea of playing Chopin, which she does a lot, is not just the idea of knowing Chopin's work, it's the idea of grappling with the 200 years of people who have played the music since then, which can be a very positive, powerful experience, and it can also be an absolutely emotionally crippling experience to be like thinking that you're always being compared to the people who've done it before.
Yeah.
We think one of the things we like about what we do is, since we're usually the first to do a piece because we tend to just do new stuff with composers, this process of being emotionally involved from the beginning of it is really fun and rewarding for us. I mean, we're basically grappling with ourselves, is what Josh is saying.
We also, too, like there was this really interesting Radiolab episode where they talked about Beethoven's metronome being wrong or being miscalibrated. So a lot of his tempo markings are really fast, and people don't generally play his symphonies as fast as he's marked them. And so the tempo that Beethoven marked is like kind of insane and has this energy that you can't get to. And so there's these, it's like maybe Beethoven just liked stuff like that energy. You just couldn't get that energy unless you played at that tempo. And he reminded us a lot of the conversations we have with like David Lang, because David Lang asks us to do things that are purposefully ridiculous because you can't, there's no way that you can get the energy in the room without having to like reach all the way over here to get this one crotale note.
Yeah.
It'd just be much easier to put it right in front of you, but he wants it to be over here so that the audience sees this cool struggle. It's hard to convey that to an audience, but oftentimes those stories and those, that sort of way of getting to that are lost because...
this sort of performative
element because of often a performance tradition that builds with, especially pieces by Beethoven, over a long period of time. But if you go back to the very core of why certain things were marked the way they were, maybe it was because he was deaf and he wanted to see the energy, and you could see the energy when people were doing this, and it was just like, it was an experience for him that people don't often get today because performance tradition is sort of rounded and smoothed off the edges.
The last question I'll ask you guys, and it's super abstract, but like, usually when people talk to me about playing a composition, at some point they start to tell me the story that they hear in the piece. And is there a story, either shared or individual, that you guys kind of hear in this piece that's being told?
I will say, this is Adam, it's good that you asked us an abstract question because we're pretty abstract thinkers. and it may be different for each of us. We tend, especially with music like this, not to really get too much into the world of of narrative, mm-hmm. in the sense of like, this is the story that's being told. A lot of music works really well in those kinds of, a lot of classical music works really well in those, in that kind of thinking. For us, a lot of it tends to be things like rhythm, structure, architecture, sound. I mean, mm-hmm. more kind of abstract concepts, and how are we dealing with those concepts? And this piece in particular is very sectional. If you listen through it, you'll find that a section happens, and you know, Baroque music is more like this, where it'll go kind of in one idea for a while, and then it'll just stop, and the next thing will start. Mm-hmm. A lot of Romantic music tends to elide those things more, and that's where a lot of storytelling type music comes from, is this idea of Strauss, and now we are in this scene, and now we come into this and that. This music tends to be a section where an idea happens, and then a new section starts, and it's a very different idea. Mm-hmm. And those kind of blocks of sound and structure and rhythm and musical ideas tend to be what I think what motivate us.
Yeah, I feel like it's really experiential music. It's like both to sit down and listen to it, but definitely the live experience. I think you, it does take you on a journey, but the journey is an abstract journey. But I think there's a, for me, it's joyous music. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something to the live performance. I think there's something to watching to the way the four of us interact and kind of make our way through this music. Mm-hmm. And I kind of love it. I mean, talking about the collaboration with Bryce, I think, when we talk about this piece of music, you know, I think we talk about it as a we, like we feel really invested in it, you know?
Yeah, I've noticed
and,
that.
You know, and
yeah.
I think we, that's what we do with all the projects we invest in. But seeing it from Bryce's side, I think a lot of the music he writes is more, can be more narrative. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was really telling that he titled this one Music for Wood and Strings. The rest of his pieces, St. Caroline by the Sea, Murder Ballads,
Lacrimae,
Tenebrae, like are really kind of... you know, more kind of evoke a setting or a narrative or uh-huh. something that he's drawing on. And this, to me, was him kind of giving almost our background a shout out and saying, like, where we come from, a lot of it is, you know, John Cage was writing music, first, second, third, construction. You know, that was where we started with. These are constructions, you know, and Steve Reich would write music called drumming. Because there were drums.
Uh-huh. Like, you know, music for 18 musicians.
Right, because there were 18 musicians. Clapping music, because you clap. You know, it was really like this title is like what the music is.
Yeah.
And I think him titling this piece Music for Wood and Strings was kind of saying like, yeah, this is where this band comes from. And let me see what I can do. And it's totally a journey. And I think everybody can make their own story. But I think for me, the essence of it is more a little more kind of experiential, like I said, and kind of about the instruments and about what can be brought out of them.
Yeah.
Most of the piece is very structured with all these rhythmic hockets and stuff. Mm-hmm. The very end is just this kind of little coda ending where we do some things that sound more like what you're talking about, what people imagine experimental music sounds like, with kind of cool things sliding in and out. So what you hear there is we start to use slides. Uh-huh. And this is the first time in the piece that we've kind of done something like this.
Kind of going for a Hawaiian vibe.
It works.
Come on, Rai Cooter is the shout out.
That's a crazy sound. And how much of that is production? Like, this just the instrument?
Yeah, that's the thing.
It's
like,
all live.
That's what I was saying. We talked early on, like, oh yeah, let's add reverb or distortion. And then when we started to play it, I think we just realized the sound is so... There's so much sound there.
But this
already is
also part of the percussionist toolkit. It's like, we're playing with pencils. What if we have a soft side and a hard side? And what
so
if we
this,
do this?
This last sound is also the first time we've done this, just kind of patting your hands on the instrument. And then we do this big crescendo. It's weird. It's a totally different way to end it. This whole kind of last section comes after this big climax. And it's kind of like this, the calm.
So cool.
Wow, I never listen to our albums after we make them, and that sounds awesome. It makes me want to listen to it, actually. It's a great ending.
He never does.
Like, also, we're awesome.
Everything we listen to is slower than we play it now.
Yeah.
Well, Eric, because you have been conspicuously quiet, I am going to let you have the last word. Do you have... What about you? What about your sort of connection to the piece?
Well, yeah, I was just thinking about... this is Eric. I was just thinking about that... There's definitely not, I think, a narrative in the piece in the sense of, you know, this is the section where the protagonist goes to war and comes back and whatever, you know. It's not that kind of story, but I do think there's a story of memory that happens in the piece. And I think it's in this particular piece, there's sort of a narrative of materials or something that goes throughout, because I love listening to that last track and realizing that the two main sounds that happen in that track are things that haven't been used in the entire piece up to that point. And so he sort of saves these two really outrageously new sounds that he could have used throughout the whole piece, but at the very end you get these sounds that you haven't been expecting to hear the whole time and are some of the more unusual ones that happen in the piece. But it's sort of all the different sections introduce new things. You know, we start off with bowing them, we don't actually even hit them first thing in the piece, then we hit them with the bows, and then we hit them with the other side of the bows, and then we strum them, and then we hit them with the soft side of the sticks we're using. It's like constantly introducing new things, and each of those creates a memory of what's possible with the instrument. And by the time you get to the end and you're hearing these crazy new sounds, you've gone through all of these other sections that you have memory of, and so you're comparing those crazy sounds to now what has become the standard sound of the instrument that you've heard for the 30 minutes before that. And I think that's actually a pretty amazing thing to do, to take a brand new thing and give it to an audience and then do it long enough that by the end they have a memory of what it was at the beginning.
It becomes familiar.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so they've formed like a new memory that they've, yeah. That's really interesting.
Leave it to Eric, man.
Man,
right?
That was good. That was good stuff to end on. All right. Well, Adam Slewinski, Jason Truding, Eric Chabich, Joss Quillen, So Percussion, thank you for being on the Classical Classroom today. And also Aaron Sanchez and Bryce Desner. It was great to have you guys on the show. All right, everybody. That does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom. You can find us wherever podcasts live, iTunes, etc. Make sure to subscribe to us, rate us, and review us. Promise us your unborn children. You can also follow us on Twitter and Tumblr and on our YouTube channel. Send me email at dclay@houstonpublicmedia.org. Thanks today to audio producer Todd Tex Holslander for making us sound nice. Thanks to program director Sinjin Flynn for pretending to be British every single day. We're almost convinced. Thanks to editor Mark DiClaudio for his piercing button eyes. Thanks to the members of So Percussion and to Bryce Desner and Aaron Sanchez for being here today, and to Brassland for hooking us up with these guys. Thanks to me for saying words, but most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.